Hi.
Hello.
Welcome back to Old Millennials, a deep dive on shallow topics from the late 90s and early 2000s. We are your hosts. I'm Emily.
And I'm Margo.
Welcome back. We're excited today because we are going to be talking about the one, the only, Miss Jennifer Lopez.
It might be a J-Lo-naissance.
Yes.
Currently, but we're going to take you back to the peak of her rom-com career today.
And boy, did she have one.
Yes. I mean, as much as I want to talk about Hustlers or her most recent tour Oscar. Where she celebrated being 50.
And fabulous.
Yes. Her runway walk that was a Versace Google Images SpawnCon subterfuge that
she
you
wore
didn't
the
even
dress
see.
Again.
I know.
She wore the dress. And but she looked so goddamn good.
Did you hear that it's actually sponsored by Google Images, though?
That's amazing.
She actually made SpawnCon money. It's an actual sponsorship.
That's amazing.
Because they were celebrating, she's the very first Google image to have ever been archived in that dress.
To our Mountain View listeners, if any of you had anything to do with that collaboration, please email us.
I don't
know. Oldmillennialspod@gmail.com.
It must be some sort of ad agency that brokered that deal. I don't know how else that would have worked. You know, her adorably high-key Instagram boyfriend slash fiance who used to be a baseball player but mostly is known for wearing polos now. We can't talk about any of that. Hopefully she obviously gets nominated for an Oscar because we are team justice for the movie Selena.
Of course.
But right now,
anything for Selena's.
J-Lo's career has not only persisted, but she's thrived. I feel like since this rom-com period, she has only gone on to do bigger and better things. Do you
yes.
not agree?
Oh, no. And made a ton of money while doing it.
Also has a perfume empire, which we're not talking about today.
We're not even getting into that.
There's too much. You got to break Jenny from the block up into different pieces. You can't just go all in.
Too much.
This would be like a 9-hour episode.
It would be like a Ken Burns history docuseries.
But verbal and not any visuals, because that's a lot more work than even just this podcast is.
For sure.
She has weathered high-profile relationships with Ben Affleck and Diddy and a bunch of
Mark
other
Anthony.
A bunch of other fuckboys, I was going to say. She had an ill-fitted Grammy performance last year, and also she's weathered Geely.
Yes.
She's had verifiable hits in TV and music and movies, which
Fashion.
Is wild. Obviously, she's more popular now than she's ever been, and she's incredibly strategic in her career. And even though she's been a certified diva for some time, I think her rom-com career proves that not only is she a lead, but she can make a box office hit even if it's a complete turd. So J-Lo is the queen of busy business ladies who are too busy to fall in love, which is typically a Lifetime trope. But because of her star power, even as far back as 2001 with The Wedding Planner, when it wasn't quite yet verified yet that she was going to be this total superstar, because I believe her efforts were still pretty split down the middle between movies and music, but she was getting away from TV. And her charisma and her star power otherwise elevated this kind of like so-so script, which is like a theme throughout all of these movies.
For sure.
The Wedding Planner from 2001 is rotten at 16%. And in the Jennifer Lopez canon, The Wedding Planner is sandwiched between The Cell and Angel Eyes, which is,
wow.
What a break. I mean, I guess she got sick of the dark.
Yes.
Because you wanted to, when we were initially trying to put together this episode, you wanted to include Angel Eyes.
Came out of my mouth, and then I was like,
And I corrected her and said, that's not a rom-com. That's also why I put enough in here initially and was like, that is also not a rom-com.
No.
We can touch on it, but let's just start with something light and fluffy. The Wedding Planner is exactly that. It goes down real smooth.
Yes.
It's directed by Adam Shankman, who this is his second appearance on this podcast.
Yeah.
It was written by Michael Ellis, who writes on Insatiable, that Netflix show now, and Pamela Falk, who has done this and one other credit to her name. And this came out in January of 2001. The setup is J-Lo plays Mary Fiore, a San Francisco wedding planner with a lot of rules. But when she meets Steve, played by the spokesperson of Lincoln Cars now, she breaks her car.
Okay, I'll just keep living.
She breaks her cardinal rule to never fall in love with the groom. She lives by the old adage of those who can't wed plan, which is like insane. And she says it very early on. I remember she has this like wild headset that's sort of like a precursor to Bluetooth, but like uglier.
Yes.
And she goes around and, like, commands this wedding, and it's, like, really perfect, and a single tear is shed by the planner
she
and the wedding.
She is the best man's yes. speech.
Like. She does everything. And honestly, I blame Jennifer Lopez for giving me a false expectation of what wedding planners can do. They're very expensive. Nobody mentions how much money she probably charges. I mean, I get that she lives in San Francisco, but it is 2001, but I guess that's the end of, like, that's
the
about.
The dot-com bubble.
It's about to burst. We're on the bubble. But in order for her to live there, yeah, as a wedding planner, she's got to charge a lot. And she really does whip it all together. She can do it all.
Amazing.
She is inexplicably made to be Italian, even though all of these Catholic cliches would have worked just fine if she was Latina. Mary is of a certain age, a.k.a. late 20s, early 30s.
Oh, no.
And is being pressured by her father, Salvatore, who is played by Alex Rocco, to get married and give him grandkids ASAP. Because, of course, she's going to wither away and die if she doesn't. Duh, everybody knows that. That's what happens when you turn 30.
Goodbye.
He tries to, like, hurry this along by reintroducing her to a childhood acquaintance, Massimo. He's the guy from Grey's Anatomy. Take it away, Emily. I don't remember what you said earlier.
He was Alex on Grey's Anatomy. I don't know if he's still on the show. I stopped watching after 2 seasons.
Well, as I said earlier, Katherine Heigl was off the show after 2 seasons, right? So I'm sure that was the end of his tenure.
Probably.
So Mary declines the setup and goes about her business of planning a wedding to catering heiress. I'm sorry. It's an heiress to a catering fortune? I don't know. Who are her parents?
There
like,
are so many, like, life served on a platter puns that I want to throw out here right now.
I mean, is her father the founder of Subway sandwiches? Like, I don't understand.
I don't know. Specialties. Maybe specialties.
Yeah, but it's 2001. Specialties wasn't here yet.
Was it not?
I don't recall. Well, I guess I wasn't invited to a sad... offer. I wasn't invited to a sad conference office lunch at this point.
You didn't have any public speaking forums to go to when you were 14?
No, and when we did go away on, like, mock trial or debate, like, field trips, so the Mormon girl in our group who was in both of those teams with me, her family owned, like, the local sandwich shop, so her parents always made us food.
That's
so
great.
Yeah, and she also supplied the van because, see, the Mormon thing, she had 6 siblings. The catering heiress, my bad. Fran, played by Bridget Wilson Sampras.
Mrs. Pete Sampras.
And also the hot girl from Billy Madison.
Veronica Vaughn.
So Mary plans Fran's wedding to her longtime boyfriend, quote unquote, Eddie. This is important later on. Tuck that one behind your ear. The meet cute. When Mary gets her shoe stuck in a manhole cover on an exceptionally clean San Francisco street, she looks up only to see a speeding dumpster coming right at her, which is hashtag relatable content.
That is very relatable content.
She starts to say a quick prayer, but wouldn't you know, just in the nick of time, she is saved by a handsome, slightly southern stranger. When she is out of harm's way, she whispers the iconic line, "You saved my shoe and my life," and then faints. She later wakes up in the hospital, and she meets Steve, who is also a pediatrician who saved her life, and she invites him to go along with her and Penny, played by Judy motherfucking Greer.
We love you, girl.
With them to an outdoor movie night that devolves into Mary and Steve dancing like you do. P.S., just a side note from, like, personal experience over here. I don't believe any dates ever go down like that in San Francisco.
No, of course not.
An old-timey movie and then, like, you just slow dance? What is this?
And you haven't seen, like, a junkie in the corner or something like that? Or
even just it being, like, organized. And also, there are only, like, 10 people there. I fucking wish I went to anything. Public event in San Francisco which had 10 people.
San Francisco is just a series of waiting in lines for things.
And also, it's not windy, and they shot that in Golden Gate Park. I do not buy this.
No drum circles? Come on.
No lost tourists in Golden Gate Park? I don't fucking buy it, you guys. There is a scam afoot. Anyway.
Caroline Calloway.
Little does Mary know, but she is dancing with the groom, otherwise known as Eddie.
Uh-oh.
Dun, dun, dun. So Steve, Eddie, and his name is now henceforth, Steve Eddie. Mary and Steve, once she finds out that Steve is also Eddie and also this groom, like all good Catholics, decides to shove it deep down inside and pretend like nothing ever happened between the two of them. Perfectly healthy, perfectly normal. Everybody knows that's exactly what you do. So, as I'm sure Mary knows, the planning of a wedding is a process that usually takes months. So, maybe pretending or not acknowledging that you guys ever had some sort of, like, weird first date is not the best approach. But, of course, this is neither here nor there because this is a rom-com, so she needs to be spending more time with Steve. And definitely never, ever bring up the fact that they went on that date. This is also the point in the movie where Massimo decides to stalk Mary into marrying him. And it's also, like, hand-waved away, like, oh, those crazy Italians. Roberto Benigni, remember him? He's kooky and Italian. What? They just stalk women. It's fine. He just shows up and, like, makes her look unprofessional and, like, ruins her day. And she keeps telling him to leave her alone. He does not do it. And he, like, spills wine on her. And the whole thing's, like, very embarrassing. I mean, I understand his purpose in this movie, narratively speaking. But I feel like upon a second rewatch in 2019 times, it might not hold up as well.
No.
At the midpoint of the movie, Fran naturally has to take a week-long business trip in the middle of planning her wedding.
As one does.
Everybody knows you schedule a week-long business trip when you're up to your fucking eyeballs with wedding planning. That's what everybody does. Duh. It's in all of the wedding planning books. Just check online. Just check the knot. Everybody knows. Fran encourages Mary and Steve to spend more time together and obviously fall in love. Mary has her own Surrey with the fringe on top in front of Ira moment when she and Steve run into her ex, who is now married and expecting a baby with the woman that he cheated on her with. Which, again, relatable content, have literally been there.
Wow.
Yeah. Yep. That was not chill. Mary tells Steve about it later, and it leads him to tell her that he's in love with her. But because J-Lo is nothing but a professional and also Catholic, she turns him down and, again, shoves her feelings just deep down inside there. She eventually agrees to marry Massimo after a combination of, like, badgering and also the scene with her father, which is actually quite beautiful. And if I recall correctly, I cried in the theater when I watched it. But as her father gives her this whole spiel, because this whole time, Mary throughout the movie is like, I want a marriage like my parents. They were so in love. My parents were in love. Like, they were the best. And, oh, my God, it was so ideal. And her father finally comes clean and tells her that his marriage to her mother was actually an arranged marriage. And at first her mother hated him, and then one time early on in their marriage, he got very sick and she took care of him. And that sort of, like, resentment, like, slowly melted away, and it turned into respect, which turned into friendship, which eventually turned into love. And I don't know why, but I think that monologue is a fucking bop. It's so good.
It is very
good. It gets
good.
Me every time. And it's like a combo of Alex Rocco, who is a very talented actor, RIP, and I feel like this is probably the best written part of the whole movie. She tells Massimo that she agrees to marry him via a dollhouse. And I remember I liked that scene, but also maybe on second glance, it's a little creepy. Like, dollhouses are inherently creepy.
They always are.
Towards the end, after Mary decides to marry Massimo, she thinks this is a really good idea to have a double wedding. So Fran and Steve and Mary and Massimo are getting married on the same day. But in, like, a Flintstones-esque twist, one's getting married at, like, the Ritz-Carlton in San Francisco, and then Mary, obviously being, like, you know, homely, humble Mary, is going to get married at City Hall. Mary goes to Town Hall to go get married to Massimo. Steve asks Fran if they're doing the right thing right before their wedding, because I think Fran has a panic attack and Judy Greer goes to, like, calm her down because she's dealing with this high-profile wedding. And she tells Judy Greer that she needs to talk to Steve, and that's when they come to this mutual conclusion that they shouldn't be together, sort of like The Sweetest Thing, which is another movie that we talked about earlier.
Yes.
And they leave on good terms, and Fran, like a fucking queen, goes off to, like, enjoy her honeymoon alone. So, like, props to fucking Fran. Penny reveals to Steve what Mary's marriage plans are, and he rushes over to stop her. In an M. Night Shyamalan-esque twist at the town hall wedding, Mary's dad stops the ceremony, realizing that this wedding is not what Mary wants. Mary insists that life is not a fairy tale, and that she's going to marry Massimo, and that's the right thing to do. But Massimo realizes that this is what she wants, and he stops the wedding, and he decides to stop stalking her, and he leaves. Steve arrives to find Mary's father and Massimo, and they tell Steve that she called off the wedding, she didn't get married, and that she's at that outdoor movie park deal, which happens very frequently, apparently.
Yeah.
Maybe it's summer? Is it Sundown Cinema, you think?
Probably.
Anyway, he rushes over to go and find her, and they have this whole, like, moment about M&Ms, and they slow dance, and they end up happily ever after, and they finally kiss. Some fun facts about this movie, especially this one. This is my favorite. I love would have been casting. I don't know why. It really tickles me. Originally, Mary and Steve were first supposed to be played by Jennifer Love Hewitt and Brendan Fraser.
What?
Yes. First, which in 2001 times, like, that kind of makes sense. That's, you know, around the time of I Know What You Did Last Summer and The Mummy. Like, all of that kind of tracks for me. So they dropped out, and then they were replaced with Sarah Michelle Gellar and Freddie Prinze Jr.
Huh.
Which also makes sense, but then yeah. Scheduling conflicts and other stuff happened, so then they had to drop out. They probably went to go, like, do the Scooby-Doo movie.
Yeah.
So J-Lo and McConaughey were actually the third choice.
Wow. How?
The Wedding Planner is often compared to My Best Friend's Wedding. Monster in Law is also compared to another movie, which is why I put that little fun fact in there. Out of Failure to Launch, How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, and this movie, McConaughey ranks The Wedding Planner dead fucking last. What an idiot. I actually think it goes How to Lose a Guy, Wedding Planner, and then Failure to Launch.
I would agree with that. I don't know why he would think Failure to Launch is a better movie. I have recently rewatched it, and yeah, he and SJP don't really have that much chemistry.
They don't. I really don't think that, especially in that role, I don't feel like she would have fallen for that guy. Maybe if she were more Carrie, and also, like, really early season Carrie.
Yeah.
She might have, like, dated him to get back at Big or something, and I could have conceivably bought into that. But in the movie, I was just like, you guys don't have any chemistry, and it's kind of boring, and I don't think I finished it, but I definitely watched it on the plane. How to Lose a Guy is just a really good, dumb rom-com. It's perfect. And as Matthew McConaughey said in this episode of Watch What Happens, where he ranked all of these movies, How to Lose a Guy is apparently a good mailbox movie, which means that he gets a fat residual check all the time because this movie is playing constantly.
It's always on USA.
It's on E. Yes. It's on Bravo, actually, yes. Too. It's on TNT. It's on everything. I feel like you could catch it at least once a month if you try.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
J.Lo was nominated for a Razzie for Worst Actress, which is rude. I thought she actually was really good in this movie, as sort of like a timid, uptight woman who doesn't believe she deserves love and she should only do it for other people.
There had to have been far worse movies that came out that year than that movie.
Because we're not How Did This Get Made, I did not look up the worst movies that came out that year, since it's just centered on J-Lo. But this movie was critically panned, and it made $13 million Super Bowl weekend, which was its opening weekend. It overall made $60 million with a $35 million budget, which I don't think is bad. But it, again, goes along with sort of the narrative that follows this period of her movies where they were critically panned, but then they made back all of their money, so it wasn't, like, a total bust. And it obviously, she just, like, cruises on by anyway. It's just another thing. She has 111 credits, so this is just, like, another notch, you know?
Way to go, J-Lo.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's also, what was that movie, or that TV show she did with Ray Liotta a couple years ago that actually wasn't bad, like, Dark Blue or something.
Yeah.
Anyway, like, there are, like,
Rookie
two seasons.
Blue.
Rookie Blue. No, that's something that, whatever. Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Either way, she's got some, like, a lot of TV in there, too, but she's got a shit ton of credits. It's wild. And that's all I have for The Wedding Planner, which is a movie that I greatly enjoyed. If I didn't see it opening weekend, I definitely saw it the following weekend. For some reason, I was either forced or I had to watch my stepbrother for the afternoon, and we went to go see it together. And he's not historically a rom-com guy, but he actually really enjoyed it, and we really liked The Wedding Planner, and we had some inside jokes around seeing it, and I remember the theater being packed, and it was an enjoyable movie, but again, 17% of Rotten Tomatoes tells us otherwise, but I wonder if it holds up in a second rewatch.
I feel like it would be, you know, again, like, much like How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, if I saw it on USA or TNT or Bravo, I'd stop and watch it probably. You know,
yeah, and definitely leave it on in a background.
Yeah, it's great background noise.
Well, it's all you.
Well, I did Made in Manhattan, which was another one of those rom-coms that J-Lo was in where it was panned by critics, but it made pretty good money. Currently holds a 39% rating on Rotten Tomatoes. It was released on December 13th, 2002, and was directed by Wayne Wang, who's also known for directing The Joy Luck Club, Anywhere But Here, Because of Winn-Dixie, and Last Holiday.
What happened? I like Last Holiday. It's fun.
Yeah. No, it is fun. And I love Anywhere But Here. That's another one that's on, like, TNT or whatever. I'm going to watch it. And then Joy Luck Club's a really good movie.
Is Anywhere But Here the Natalie Portman one?
Yes.
Okay.
And the one that Mona Simpson wrote. It's based on the book. I think she was Steve Jobs' half-sister, right? Like, they share a father.
Is this the one where she has a kid in a Walmart?
No. That's Where the Heart Is.
Ah.
Around the same time.
I know. I saw both of them probably back-to-back.
Yeah. So the movie was directed by Wayne Wang. The script was written by Kevin Wade, who is known for writing Working Girl, which also has kind of a modern Cinderella twist, so I thought that was kind of interesting. He also wrote Mr. Baseball, Junior.
Wait, what's Mr. Baseball?
That's with Ted Danson. It's one of those in the, like, early 90s, late 80s, there were a bunch of, like, baseball comedies that came out. I don't think I've ever seen it in its entirety, but it's one of those movies that came out around then. And then Meet Joe Black.
Oh, my God. Whoa, that you did not prepare me for that. I feel a little betrayed.
He also created and executive produced that show Kashmir Mafia with Lucy Liu that lasted for about a season.
Was that on ABC?
Yeah, it was. It was like Sex in the City, but with women who have real jobs.
Oh, and it has, what's her face? She's always in shows that get canceled, too.
Yeah, there's Miranda Otto. No. There's blonde chick was...
She's friends with Sarah Michelle Gellar. What the fuck is her name?
I'm blanking on it as well.
She used to come into my old job all the time. She's very nice, like Vanessa something?
Yeah, something
Vanessa
like
Marceau?
That. No.
Whatever.
Anyway.
It's gone now.
The plot of this movie goes as follows. It is a modern Cinderella retelling. So Jennifer Lopez plays Marisha Ventura, a woman who works as a maid at the Beresford Hotel in, of course, Manhattan, hence the movie's title. Marissa is a single mom to Ty, who's played by Teen Wolf himself, Tyler Posey, which I did not remember until I researched this movie. Marissa's coworker friends believe she has all the talent and skill to become a manager at the hotel and secretly submit an application on her behalf to become one.
I'm so sorry. Can we just pause for a quick second? She was in that movie with Vanessa Hudgens recently. That's like a very similar plot.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
That is a trip that they then remade this movie again.
Pretty much.
Great.
One day, she's cleaning the room of a socialite named Caroline Lane, played by the late Natasha Richardson, R.I.P., and Caroline asks her to return a Dolce & Gabbana coat for her. One of Marissa's coworker friends, Stephanie, convinces Marissa to try on the coat, which, of course, looks amazing on her because she is J-Lo. Meanwhile, Ty, Marissa's son, meets Chris Marshall in the elevator. Chris, who's played by Ralph Fiennes, which, oh my God, like, did anyone ever expect to see Ralph Fiennes in this? No. Is running for Senate and is talking to his campaign manager, Jerry, played by Stanley Tucci, while on his way to walk his dog.
The Tucci is loose.
Aw, yeah. Ty pets his dog, and Chris and him start talking because Ty, in order to go full method for his school presentation on Richard Nixon, is listening to the 70s soft rock band Red on a Walkman. After Ty impresses Chris by knowing his political record as an assemblyman, Chris asks Ty to join him on a walk with his dog. Ty goes up with Chris to Caroline's room, where Marissa is cleaning slash trying on the Dolce & Gabbana coat, to ask for permission to go walk the dog. Chris is immediately into Marissa, of course, believing that she's Caroline Lane, the socialite. The three go for a walk with the dog, and while it's clear the two have feelings for one another, Marissa tries to avoid seeing Chris after this out of fear that she will lose her job for it. Chris then sends a lunch invitation to Caroline's hotel room by way of the hotel butler Lionel, played by Bob Hoskins, and Marissa is in the room when Caroline receives it, because he believes, of course, that Marissa is in fact Caroline. When the real Caroline goes to the lunch date, Chris is confused and later asks Jerry to find the real Caroline and invite her to a big gala that will help his campaign. Jerry asks Lionel to find her, and Lionel quickly figures out that it's Marissa he's looking for, so Lionel gives her the dinner invite but tells her to break it off so as not to ruin her future career in hotel management.
Sorry, that's a funny sentence.
I didn't think I'd get to utter that.
Yeah, surprises.
Marissa gets a pretty woman montage, of course, and her friends around the hotel help glamour up for the night by doing her hair and makeup and loaning her a dress and Harry Winston diamond necklace, as one does. Marissa, still known as Caroline to Chris, and Chris have a great time at the gala, which leads them to spending the night together in his room at the hotel. The next morning, the real Caroline sees her leaving his room and tells the hotel management, who then fire her in front of Chris. They break things off, and the press finds out about the story and continuously hounds the two of them. Marissa finds work as a maid in another hotel where Chris has a press conference one day about his run for Senate. Ty pulls a Hugh Grant in Notting Hill and attends the conference, asking Chris about believing in second chances while making jokes about politicians being forgiven. Chris responds yes and walks into the crowd to follow Ty to the hotel staff room where Marissa is on her break, with the press and his campaign manager following him. The two reconcile with a quote-unquote reintroduction where she introduces herself as Marissa Ventura, housekeeping.
I remember that so vividly.
And he introduces himself as Chris Marshall, senatorial candidate. We find out by way of an ending epilogue of magazine covers that Chris gets elected, Marissa starts her own hotel management business with her friends, and they live happily ever after. So, despite mixed reviews, particularly around the predictability of this plot and the lack of chemistry between Jennifer Lopez and Ralph Fiennes.
Oh, yeah.
Which, again, they're both great actors, just not together.
Yeah, exactly. They had negative chemistry. They felt like two people giving a really long handshake. It was very bizarre.
A very polite handshake.
I don't know how you put those two together and think, mm-hmm, yeah, they fuck. You're like, wait, what? Where?
No. What planet? Made in Manhattan went on to gross $155 million worldwide on a budget of $55 million. It actually went on to inspire a very popular telenovela called Una Maid in Manhattan that was produced and aired on Telemundo.
The premiere robbed that I didn't know about this. Right?
The premiere drew 1.6 million viewers, and the series finale drew 2.1 million and had 168 episodes.
Well, it is a telenovela, Emily.
Of course.
Minimum 100 episodes.
At least, and that's a bad show. Behind the scenes, the film script is credited to Kevin Wade as the main writer, but John fucking Hughes has a story by credit under his usual pseudonym as Edmond Dantes, which is the one, his constant pseudonym throughout his career when he wrote Beethoven and he wrote Drillbit Taylor and this movie or inspired the story.
Oh my God, I forgot he wrote Drillbit Taylor.
Yes. So that's the main character in Alexandre Dumas' The Count of Monte Cristo. And so he used that as his pen name whenever he didn't want to use his real name. So he wrote the story and then Kevin Wade went on to write the script.
Whoa.
Yes.
I never knew that.
On top of that, John Hughes.
I'm not ready.
I know. Was originally going to direct this movie.
Oh my God.
Which he, just to remind you guys, this is around early 2000s. John Hughes, stopped directing around the mid 90s and would write and produce things or had a story by credits here and there under pseudonyms. But he was out of the public eye after the mid 90s. So this was, very crazy that this would have happened.
Was it supposed to be, a comeback vehicle?
I believe so. It was also originally titled The Chambermaid and later Uptown Girl, which,
the Brittany Murphy movie, hello.
Dakota Fanning is, I know. Hilary Swank was originally set to play the main role.
And, what?
Yeah, I know.
Okay.
And Ralph Fiennes' character was supposed to be a British guest, which would have been more, it just would have been a way better idea because if you listen to Ralph Fiennes' American accent, he is a fantastic actor, deserves all the accolades, made a great Voldemort. He cannot do an American accent. I'll just leave it at that.
Well, this was pre Meghan and Harry, so they didn't even know you could do that.
I know. Surprising. They started filming this movie just a few months after 9/11, so as a result, they're pretty careful about not having too many skyline shots, if I recall correctly. Some of the interesting observations I made in this movie, after learning that Kevin Wade wrote the script to this movie and Working Girl, this does feel like a Working Girl for the 2000s, except more explicitly tied to the Cinderella connection since J-Lo is a hotel maid instead of a secretary. This movie had an amazing cast. Jennifer Lopez, Ralph Fiennes, Natasha Richardson, Bob Hoskins, Priscilla Lopez, who's a very famous Broadway actress, Stanley Tucci, who might have been the most underused in this film.
The Tooch was not loose.
Indeed. Followed by Amy Sedaris. Chris.
What?
She plays Natasha Richardson's best bitchy friend.
Oh. Yeah, talk about perpetually the best friend.
She's a fantastic.
Amy Sedaris, Judy Greer.
I mean, so many good best friend actresses in these movies.
Casey Rose Wilson.
Chris Hageman is in this. I don't remember. I don't know how you pronounce his last name. He's in all those Whit Stillman films like The Last Days of Disco and Metropolitan Barcelona. And then even Tyler Posey. I hate a lot of children actors, but he was, I realize I just said children actors, child actors. But he was actually not annoying. He had his moments, of course, but he was not as annoying as some of the kids we've had to see in some of these movies we've had to review. And while this isn't a great movie, I don't ultimately hate it because you have so many good actors in it. The same goes for the people behind the scenes. Kevin Wade, again, wrote Working Girl, was nominated for every single award when that was released. Wayne Wang has written directed several great indie films. And this was a John Hughes story. So there's a lot of good elements there. And even there's this great article in the AV Club that points out that while this movie is just, another rom-com, there is nothing about this that's really special from a plot perspective, that it's actually a well-directed film from a technical and camera angle perspective. There are really beautiful shots in this movie, despite the film itself having a really kind of predictable plot. A nice great piece on The Ringer points out that even though this movie isn't as offensive as many other rom-coms we've had to revisit in the last few seasons, it probably just shouldn't be remade because the main character is a woman of color, which is great. But she's playing a maid, and it's you really couldn't have thought of something else.
It truly felt like they were playing into a stereotype,
Absolutely.
And it felt a little bit derivative.
Absolutely.
Even for the time.
Even for the time.
Especially because J-Lo had been in so many other movies where she
was not didn't have playing
to,
a mic.
Exactly. She didn't have to, she was a fucking wedding planner in San Francisco.
Exactly.
Why couldn't she just be
a pop, an age of a pop singer?
Why couldn't she be a concierge?
I don't know. But on top of that, all the other characters of color in this film are her friends who are also maids as well, or are, but you know, are just people who work around the hotel as more domestic workers. And so it ultimately, J-Lo does get her man and gets the career she wants, as we find out in the magazine cover epilogue. The other thing that's really problematic here is that we're supposed to believe that, like, she's going to just give up everything, her career possibilities and all that, to be in a relationship with someone who ultimately will not suffer any consequences if they get caught. So she loses her job when he finds out that she is a maid. And she,
okay, but she was wearing someone else's clothes. I'm sure that's the fireable offense, right?
Yes, but at that point she wasn't. So like she was caught wearing the coat in the beginning, and she was scolded by the Natasha Richardson's character. But ultimately, like, it wasn't the big infraction. She just went and confessed because she was kind of jealous that J-Lo had ended up with Ralph Fiennes' character instead of her, because they had gone on a date before when he thought she was Caroline or whatever. But really, this movie, I mean, it's not one of those where it's like horribly, horribly offensive that it should have never been made and should never be made in 2019. But there are just enough things about it where I'm like, yeah, I think we can do better on original scripts first and foremost, and then other things that would be better to remake.
Well, it's called, like, the do-over or whatever it is now with Vanessa Hudgens, so.
Yeah.
And by the way, to just circle back to Kashmir Mafia, the actress that I was thinking of wasn't in Kashmir Mafia. She was actually in Lipstick Jungle, which came out around the same time.
Very similar.
And her name is Lindsay Price.
Oh, yeah.
That was who I was thinking of. Oh. But yeah, I remember when that Vanessa Hudgens movie came out, where it was basically, like, younger and Made in Manhattan, like, smushed together, because the twist that Vanessa Hudgens is, like, her daughter that she gave up for adoption or whatever is, I don't know, something else. I don't know where that came from. But the, like, lying about how old you are and on her resume, that whole thing, and then getting a job and then pretending to be somebody else, like, that's kind of, like, Made in Manhattan, but updated to, like, not make her a maid. Not like there's anything wrong with it, but obviously they were playing into some sort of stereotype in Made in Manhattan.
For sure.
And made, like, to make her lesser than or, like, undeserving of, like, the white senator guy who probably has some, like, way more fucked up shit in his past than being a fucking maid. One can only hope to just be a maid.
Yeah. So that's what I have on Made in Manhattan.
Well, we're gonna jump ahead to 2005 because, you know, I could talk about Enough, which I can't stress enough is not a rom-com. It's actually what I, in my brief research before, I was like, this is too dark. This is, like, too dark and, like, a weird detour to take. It's actually based on a book, which I didn't know, but I've seen Enough a lot of times, partly because it's always on TV in some weird way, but I definitely either saw it in theaters or rented it because, of course, who's not a J-Lo fan? I kind of think of Enough as being, it's Home Alone, but make it escaping your abuser, because the house at the end is really, like, amazingly booby-trapped. But I do think Enough, even though it's a 22% on Rotten Tomatoes, has a good performance from Jennifer Lopez. I think Billy Crudup, who's, like, the abusive husband, is also good. It's, like, a great mix of scary. Sure, it could be, like, a Lifetime movie, but I feel like similar to Unforgettable with Katherine Heigl, or even, oh, God, The Intruder, that movie with Megan Good and Dennis Quaid that came out this year, too, which could have been...
Yes, it was what you're talking about.
Yeah, I saw... So me and my best friend love to see these, like, cheap thrillers in theaters because they're just really fun. And sometimes you do get really good actors like a Megan Good or a Katherine Heigl or a Jennifer Lopez, who are really great actresses. So they elevate this sort of, like, would-have-been kind of soapy-ish script and actually make it really fun and interesting and compelling, and they bring some layers and, you know, they polish a turd. They do their job. So, you know, that's Enough, but so in between Enough, before Monster in Law, in the J-Lo canon, this is after Shall We Dance, which is like that Richard Gere, Susan Sarandon movie where she teaches Richard Gere how to dance so that he can, like, fall back in love with his wife or something. I remember seeing the trailer and being like, no thanks, I'm good. And this, and then after Monster in Law, she'll go on to do An Unfinished Life, which looks kind of like a budget indie that nobody really watched, that like wanted to be something like maybe like a Sundance winner or a possible indie darling that could get nominated for an Oscar. I don't think it worked because I don't remember this movie coming out. And I didn't bother to look at what it was about because the poster annoyed me. So Monster in Law came out Mother's Day weekend in 2005 because that's exactly what you want to do with your mother on her special day. Drag her to a movie that basically says moms are fucking crazy. This movie was directed by Robert Ludicik. I can't read anymore.
Lukadek? It's either Lukadek or Lukadek.
It's directed by Lukadek? It's not getting any more confident. He's the director behind Legally Blonde. That's his biggest hit.
Ah.
And it was written by Anya Kotcheff, who wrote Mother's Day. Mm. And I am holding her personally responsible for Julia Roberts' wig. J.Lo plays another inexplicably Italian character named Charlie Cantanilli. Charlie is a quote-unquote free spirit, a.k.a. she's a freelancer. She walks dogs. She teaches yoga, fucking of course. And most importantly, she's an aspiring fashion designer. I fucking hate this. This is like some manic pixie dream girl nightmare. Mm. Somehow she can afford to live in fucking Venice Beach. Must be rent control. She has a meet-cute one day with Michael Vartan's Kevin, which, again, like the least romantic name. I actually once broke up with a guy named Kevin in high school because Kevin's, like, not hot. Like, that's not a hot, that's not a good...
Reminds me of Billy Crystal being like Sheldon. Like, you don't make love to a Sheldon.
to bring it back to when Harry met Sally. I mean, Kev is cool. Like, I like a Kev, but a Kevin, like, you insist on being called Kevin? Anyway, he's conveniently a doctor, so she'll definitely have this fashion line dream realized. Things are obviously amazing at first, but then things inevitably take a wrong turn when Kevin introduces Charlie to his mother, Viola Fields, who is played by Jane Fonda. Amazing. I don't even know. This is a great get. I have no idea how this happened. Viola is a former newscaster who was recently replaced by a younger woman, and she's in the middle of like a midlife crisis. On site, she fucking hates Charlie, which immediately makes this movie not fun. Like, I get it's the point, but when she, before Charlie could even do anything terrible, she's like, I fucking hate you. Like, how does that even happen? Just hates the cut
Jane
of her.
Fonda is better than that. She would have to have a reason to hate someone.
I mean, some of this really plays, like, I feel like this is a good groundwork for what will inevitably be her character on Grace and Frankie. I feel like she does a lot of this, like, screaming in a beautiful home a lot really well. Mm. And she does it a lot on Grace and Frankie. And she is pretty bitchy, and she is bitchy in the show. And we hadn't really seen her be this kind of, like, bitchy, saucy broad because she was, like, the muse and an ingenue and having threesomes with that terrible husband that she had. You know, like, she was all of those things. And then she hadn't been on screen, and I'll talk about it a little bit later, but she hadn't been on screen in a really long time. So it was really an interesting departure. But I think, you know, other than Jane Fonda's performance and Jennifer Lopez, too, and anytime they cut to them, just the two of them interacting without the Michael Vartan factor, it is incredible that they have both of these fucking people in the same movie. And this is probably one of those movies that also, in retrospect, or maybe even at the time, did not pass the Bechdel test. So she hates Charlie immediately, and she becomes even more distraught when Kevin proposes to Charlie in front of her. She's obviously fearing that she's going to lose her son, but also she's in the middle of a midlife crisis, and that's what you do when you need to, like, grasp onto control. You just immediately hate people, and so you're going to take it all out on your son and his seemingly nice girlfriend. Ruby, who's played by Wanda Sykes, is Viola's assistant, and she tries everything with the assistance of Wanda Sykes' character. She tries everything to stop Charlie from marrying Kevin. At some point, Elaine Stritch gets in the mix as Kevin's grandmother, Gertrude, who obviously instantly loves Charlie because Gertrude and Viola have a blood feud because Gertrude, her son, married Viola, and she's always fucking hated her. And so the cycle continues. Don't you see? Jane Fonda has to hate Charlie. She has to attempt to fucking poison her by giving her nuts, even though she knows that she's deathly allergic to fucking nuts. I don't like, I've never found this to be funny. Be like, ooh, let's poison him. Like, even in Mrs. Doubtfire.
Yeah, no. Allergies, like, yes, are not something to mess around with.
Yes, Pierce Brosnan is a dick, but do you fucking try and kill him?
That's not a hijink. That's like murder.
It's literally murder. If anybody could ever discover that you did not accidentally poison them, you would go to fucking jail. You'd be charged with fucking manslaughter. What are you doing? This is not comedy. It's insane. Anyway.
Boom, boom.
Oh, I'm dead. Like, why is that funny? That's it. I mean, I know you just laughed.
I'm not laughing at that. I'm laughing at the, like, thought of at our making
great,
that.
At our great bit work.
Exactly.
So Charlie rightfully fucking tries to call off this wedding, and Viola has some sort of, like, 11th hour fucking epiphany and realizes that she wants Charlie to stay, and they reconcile, and Charlie and Kevin eventually get married, and Viola and Ruby go off into the sunset, and that's the end of it. Monster in Law is nothing special. It is fairly predictable. It does have a very a followable plot, right? Like, you know, like, this evil mother-in-law is going to show up, and you're going to get that, like, it's just, like, hazing. She's got to hate Charlie, yada, yada. That they're going to make up, and that she's going to end up with Michael Vartan and all this other shit. She's going to have her fucking design line and own this shop on Venice Beach. But what's interesting is sort of, like, the behind the scenes. So this film was a really big deal because of Jane Fonda's return to the screen. She hadn't been in a movie since 1990. Her last film before this was Stanley and Iris. Jane Fonda had even confessed that the screenplay sucked, but she chose this as her comeback vehicle because she knew a lot of people would go see it because of this was, like, the height of Jennifer Lopez popularity. I'm not sure where we are in the Bennifer timeline. I think this is, like, the post, but I feel like even...
Yeah, definitely post.
I think that even after they broke up, she, like, got even bigger because she ditched the fucking dud.
She was dating the backup dancer, and I think it's around the time she probably married Mark Anthony.
This follows another trend, and also Jane Fonda's gut was right. This movie made a shit ton of money. Even though it was panned by critics, Monster in Law went on to make $154 million on a $43 million budget, which is bonkers. Monster in Law is Jane Fonda's top-grossing film of the past quarter century. Mark Ruffalo was the first choice for a lead over Michael Vartan, which honestly probably would have been a slightly better movie with Mark Ruffalo, but it's probably just because I'd rather see Mark Ruffalo's face. J-Lo earned another Golden Raspberry Award nomination for Worst Actress, but lost to fucking anti-vaxxer Jenny McCarthy for Dirty Love, and that fucking serves that dumb bitch right.
Two podcasts in a row she's come up.
Get her out of my life. I don't watch The Masked Singer. Why is this happening to me? I feel like I'm getting targeted ads because I said Masked Singer out loud once. All right, well, that's all I have for Monster in Law, which I did not enjoy seeing in theaters, have not really rewatched since, and even the trailer, it felt very, I don't know how else to describe this, but like 90s rom-com feel where like the slapstick, like Poisoner, it's funny, but in 2005, and it, even shot-wise, like you were saying, there are things about Made in Manhattan where like it's technically good and they make interesting choices. It was much more of like a broad comedy, more slapsticky, and I feel like J-Lo and Jane Fonda, even though they do really good physical comedy. I feel like it wasn't, they were doing that because of the scripts. It didn't match their skills. So they had to go down to the scripts level. And it doesn't really quite always work.
No, I feel like also, to be fair, like, I feel like it took about a decade for trailer directors to figure out how to cut rom-coms in the 2000s. Like,
oh, P.S. Just, like, they still don't know how to fucking cut a trailer.
I mean, they're still terrible at it. But it, like, in some cases, gotten slightly better. But yeah, I mean, I feel like that was one where I'm surprised it took that long to, like, figure that out. And still haven't, totally. So the movie I had to do is...
You had to?
Anyone who saw this movie, it was a had to. It's Geely. Oh, God.
How exciting.
You know, as many of these think pieces that I read while putting this together said, was Geely a really bad movie, or did we just make it out to be that because of Bennifer? And the answer to that question is, yes, it is a bad movie. We did not need the whole Bennifer fiasco for it to be a bad movie. It just was on its own a bad movie. Like, you could have told someone to watch this movie, have no historical context of that couple, and they would still say this was a terrible movie. It currently holds a 9% rating on Rotten Tomatoes.
Oh, good. I don't feel as bad about my Rotten Tomato faves.
No. See, I feel like with the Jennifer Lopez thing, it seems to be that, like, anything that has above 20% on Rotten Tomatoes is bound to make money with her. I mean, there are a couple of exceptions to that. I think Jersey Girl, which I'll talk about later. But I would
say Monster in Law is like a 17 as well. It's also low, but it made more money than The Wedding Planner. They both made back their budget and then some, which is technically a hit.
It is a hit. I think we are so used to like Marvel Cinematic Universe numbers that we can't appreciate a rom-com that would made like over $100 million. That's insane. So anyway, it was released August 1st, 2003, and it was directed by Martin Brest, who is best known for directing Beverly Hills Cop, Midnight Run, Scent of a Woman, and Meet Joe Black.
I'm sorry.
Meet Joe Black connection.
Wait, why didn't you lead with it? It was it's the same dude as Beverly Hills Cop. His commentary on Beverly Hills Cop is delightful.
I feel really bad because after this movie, Martin Brest has never made a movie since Geely.
So you get the sense in the commentary for Beverly Hills Cop that he's had a very negative Hollywood experience. I don't think it's ever really worked out the way that he's wanted. So I'm not surprised that he retired early.
And he started out on top. So his film that he made when he was a student at NYU is one of those National Register films. Like, it was entered in the Library of Congress as a significant film. So it sounds like he kind of started at top and then, you know, mid-40s, early 50s in his career, he makes Geely and it just completely bombs.
That's why you gotta... So you gotta get like me and start in the gutter. That way it can only go up.
It can only go up. I love you.
We got 200 listens on the first episode. Fuck yeah.
Woo, 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 woo. So Ben Affleck plays Larry Geely, who is in the mob but is low on the food chain. He thinks he's hot.
I fucking hate this movie so much.
He thinks he's hot shit, though. He's tasked by Lewis, who's a higher-ranking guy, to kidnap a prosecutor's mentally disabled Baywatch-obsessed brother, Brian, who's played by Justin Bartha in his first major film role, and he's being kidnapped as leverage to ensure that their mob boss, Starkman, is not put in prison.
Who is played? It's a terrible mob boss named Starkman.
It's very strange. And, of course, he's played by King of Your Heart, Mr. Al Pacino.
Hoo-ah! What do we got? We got a Geely? We got a Jersey girl?
Show me a wedding planner.
Show me your hands, Jennifer Lopez. Show me your hands.
Lewis doesn't trust Geely with carrying out this plan through, so he hires a independent contractor, quote-unquote, named Ricky.
Okay, first of all, fuck you guys, because that's an insult to all independent contractors.
Some of us have had to be that. Both you and I have had to be independent contractors. Ricky is played by Jennifer Lopez, and she is there to keep him in check so that she has eyes on him, but he has eyes on her. Geely.
That's so, it's even creepy when you say it and you're trying to be fun. It's just like a creepy line.
I know. This movie, I will read some quote highlights that come out of Ben Affleck's mouth later on, and I'm sure
I also just,
you'll appreciate it.
I love that even in the movies world, Ben Affleck's like a fuck up and he needs to be babysat to get through the day.
As the song said in Team America World Police, I need you like Ben Affleck needs acting classes. Pearl Harbor sucked, and I miss you.
I mean, I think my favorite is the rendition in Family Guy where he's like, oh, shit, I'm gonna be a British king in an hour. Hello, hello, hello. Nailed it. And then he leaves.
Ben Affleck in a nutshell. You get a middle-class Boston suburbs guy trying to do a Joy-Z accent. Albeit very unsuccessfully.
Why don't you drown me in the Atlantic?
Oh, my. Geely cannot believe his boss doesn't trust him, and he's bummed out because he finds out...
Sorry, also, it's wild that he's Geely and not Jennifer Lopez.
I spent readers until 24 hours ago. I did not know that Geely was, in fact, Ben Affleck. So Geely cannot believe his boss doesn't trust him, and he's bummed out because he finds Ricky hot, but aw, boo-hoo, she's a lesbian.
Ain't that always the case?
Rats. He's also...
Don't you hate it when you're always trying to bang lesbians?
Oh, story of my life. He's also annoyed by the fact that Ricky gets along well with his mom, played by Lainey Kazan. And if you're counting, we've seen her play Jewish, Greek, and Italian, like our girls Andrea Martin and Olympia Dukakis.
Take a drink. You just said old millennials bingo again.
Oh, my God. The two love poking fun at him. Aw, ma.
Oh, my God. Emily.
I really got into method Ben Affleck for this episode.
I heard her practicing seconds before we flipped on the mics.
I mean, next episode, if we ever have to talk about Good Will Hunting at one point, I'll practice 5 minutes prior on my Boston accent. He also constantly gets annoyed by Brian, the mentally disabled brother of the prosecutor that they have kidnapped. His continuous requests to go to the Baywatch, because he's Baywatch obsessed, and calls him a bunch of unfortunate slurs as a result because, LOL, it's 2003.
Well, also, as you stated earlier, Justin Bartha got simple jacked in this movie.
He totally got simple jacked in this movie. And we have Ben Affleck constantly telling him to, quote, act fucking normal.
I fucking hate this movie.
Martin Brest, Oscar-nominated scriptwriter, wrote this.
Well, look, what's his face? Martin McDonagh made 3 billboards outside of Epping, Missouri. We can't all fucking make the hits.
I know, that's true.
Or, as my old screenwriting teacher used to say, it's not all art.
Meanwhile, a detective played by Christopher Walken... question mark? Shows up at Geely's house questioning him about Brian's disappearance because he's a potential suspect. And things begin getting dark when Ricky and Geely are then tasked by Lewis to cut off Brian's thumb, which neither of them want to do. Then, another weird plot twist, Geely's ex-girlfriend shows up and accuses Ricky, who we have established is a lesbian, of changing her sexual orientation, and as a result, the ex-girlfriend tries to end her life by slashing her wrists. She ends up in the hospital where Ricky gets the idea to go down to the morgue in the hospital and cut a corpse's thumb off and send it to the prosecutor to pass it off as Brian's own thumb. Wow, that was a wild paragraph.
Wow, Bethany, wow. I don't know what to say.
Geely and Ricky, after that, then sleep together because, of course, Ben Affleck confesses his love, and all lesbians magically turn straight when Ben Affleck does that. Looking at you, Chasing Amy.
I truly do not think that Ben Affleck's dick is that powerful. I refuse to believe that we live in this world. We can live in this world with a lot of other shitty, terrible things like climate change, but Ben Affleck's dick cannot make a lesbian straight. I just, like, do not believe it.
It's bullshit.
Curious? Sure. Straight? No. They're not fucking dating you.
No. And curious for, like, the story, so you would be able to tell people at a bar, I fucked Ben Affleck.
Yeah, and it sucked.
Yeah. Like his acting.
Hey, what do you got on Google? So, that's my impersonation of Ben Affleck being Italian.
It's beautiful.
Thank you.
They then, after sleeping together, have to meet with the big boss, Starkman.
Like you do. Whoa. That, like, changing my sexuality pre-big meeting sex sesh.
You get a little nervous, you know? You gotta calm down. Where he...
disgusting.
Starkman then tells them he never ordered the kidnapping, but is angry because the fingerprint didn't match Brian's, and in turn... they have made a mockery of the organization.
What?
Basically, he's mad that, like, they didn't do it right, and because they figured out, the prosecutor figured out that it wasn't his brother's fingerprint.
Oh. Yeah. Okay, I got it now.
Starkman then kills Lewis, Geely's direct boss, and right before he's about to kill Ricky and Geely for pulling this, Ricky convinces him not to do it by reminding him that they're only the only ones who know where Brian is and have the ability to make sure he never says Starkman or his organization was involved with the kidnapping and potential botched severed thumb job.
Take that up with a morgue.
When they leave Starkman's place, Geely and Ricky decide that they're going to leave the mob once and for all and discuss taking Brian back to where they found him. On the way to dropping him off, they discover Baywatch is shooting an episode on the beach nearby. Brian begs to be let off there, and they let him go. And Geely convinces Ricky to take his car to escape to parts unknown. But at the last minute, Ricky returns to pick up Geely, and they leave together and supposedly live happily ever after. Okay. So behind the scenes, Halle Berry was originally cast as Ricky.
Oh, no.
Wild. But dropped out due to scheduling conflicts with the X-Men sequel X2, which, good for you, Halle Berry.
A much better movie.
J-Lo signed on for $12 million, and Affleck signed on for $12.5 million, because that's a
what the fuck?
What a douche thing.
Maybe that's why they broke up. She's like, go fuck yourself.
If you did that, claps, snaps, whatever you want to say.
I actually have a working theory that the alcoholic that we know now is probably the person that she saw then and was like, okay, and that's- also this... getting 0.5 more than me, like, go fuck yourself. Bye.
No, seriously. Everything that I watch him do on, like, Project Greenlight and, like, anything, any kind of outburst that he's had since then.
I was just like, let's not get into Project Greenlight.
Just, like, what a douche. Martin Brest. So originally, Larry Gili died in the film, which would have probably been a better movie.
Ugh, please let us kill him off in this movie.
This tested poorly with the audiences, and so they reshot the ending.
Ooh, how drop dead gorgeous of them.
I know. We've had that happen twice this season. So Brest allegedly butted heads with this chief of Revolution Studios, Joe Roth, over everything from the original ending that we had just talked about to the movie's notorious poster, which is rumored to feature a Photoshop version of Jennifer Lopez's ass. I never thought I'd get to, again, utter this sentence, but here we are. The release and the reception of this film is probably more famous than the actual film itself because
100%.
It went on to gross $7.2 million on a budget of $75.6 million. Less than 10% made.
Oh my God. Yes. That's abysmal.
It holds the record as the biggest second weekend drop in box office gross of any film in wide release since that statistic was kept. It dropped by 81.9% in its second weekend compared to its first, grossing $678,000 in its second weekend.
Oh my God.
That is Gili. The negative response led the studio to pull the advertisement for the film and replace it with other...
Jersey Girl.
Close. Bad Boys 2.
Oh, again, a better movie.
Far better movie. It was universally panned by critics, of course, everyone remembers that, who pointed to the film having so many convoluted plot elements and the leads having no on-screen chemistry, surprise, surprise. The release and reception of this film, of course, coincided with Bennifer, the couple name given, the portmanteau, if you will, given to Jennifer Lopez and Ben Affleck. Many people attribute this terrible performance at the box office on the annoyance that people had with the constant celebrity news cycle being devoted to them, which I kind of
They were very much like a Jessica Simpson and Nick Lachey, where people were fucking sick of them.
Everywhere. But honestly, I think there are far bigger reasons why this movie didn't do well.
Actually, I feel like they have much more Ariana Grande, Pete Davidson energy.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Except I have sympathy for Ariana Grande and Pete Davidson. I have sympathy
Pete,
for
Pete, you
Jay
have sympathy for Pete Davidson?
He has, like, mental illness. Like, that's not... And he's, like, grappled with depression and stuff. So, that's... For his off moments, I know he's not the best in many ways. But there are moments where...
He seems like a decent enough turd burglar.
It became the worst film in history... Slip of the tongue there. It became the first film in history to sweep the top five categories at the Razzie Awards, including Worst Picture, Worst Actor for Ben Affleck, Worst Actress for Jennifer Lopez, Worst Director for Martin Brest, and Worst Screenplay also for Martin Brest. And as I
Poor
said earlier,
Martin Brest.
Martin Brest has not directed a film since Gili.
Martin Brest is having a tough time, y'all.
Yeah. Some quick observations before we end our time with Gili. Martin Brest was a Golden Globe winning, Academy Award nominated director.
Oh, fuck.
He directed Margot's Hero Al Pacino in an Oscar winning performance. What happened here? Even for 2003, everyone involved in this movie should have known better. I fully believe sexual orientation is a spectrum, but for a woman to go from declaring herself very firmly to be being a lesbian to
She was, as I said earlier, a career lesbian.
Career lesbian. To immediately hooking up with a dude is a little far-fetched. They could have at least said she was bisexual and not made it look like being a lesbian is something that you can be convinced out of with Ben Affleck's dick. Margot and I rewatched the trailer together, and they have edited this film to look like, aw, she's just not that into him, and just casually leave out that she's gay. Justin Bartha's character is cringeworthy and evokes that one scene in Tropic Thunder.
He got simple jacked.
Martin Brest claims the role was based on patients he observed while working at Bronx State Hospital, but the offensiveness of this character makes me question this. He at one point says, quote, I think that's where the sex is, and later calls coming a pee sneeze and says, God bless you to his crotch when he comes in his pants in Gili's car, because of course he's sex obsessed. Like, what the actual fuck?
I just feel like, okay, even if best case scenario, this was something that you observed, right? Okay, fine. You don't have to do this.
No.
No one is making you add this in. He could just...
Gun to your head is not making you do this.
I mean, he could just be, I don't know, he could have amnesia. Like, I have no idea. You could have done this a number of ways.
Yeah.
He could have had face blindness. I don't know. Just, like, pick, just like, not a real thing.
Pick something just making that is him, like, not going to offend people.
A horny, mentally disabled person is... That's gross. You're being a grosso.
So, I'm going to leave us with Julie... on a few Ben Affleck quotes from this movie, because wouldn't be doing my due diligence if I didn't. A speech Gigli gives to Ricky at one point in his apartment could be best described as a soliloquy of trash. Quote, I am the fucking Sultan of Slick. I am the rule of fucking cool. You want to be a gangster? You want to be a thug? You sit at my fucking feet, gather the pearls that emanate forth from me, because I'm the original straight firstborn, most pimp, Mac fucking hustler, original gangsters, gangster.
Somebody has seen Swingers one too many times.
Oh, yeah. Couple more quotes. In every relationship, there's a bull and a cow. And this is what he tells.
I cannot handle another bull and cow reference. Okay, go ahead.
He tells Ricky this to, like, to kind of assert himself as the alpha male in the situation. It just so happens that in this relationship we're in right here with me and you, I'm the bull, you're the cow. And then, of course, because this movie couldn't get any more offensive towards lesbians, quote, that's why these lesbians are always going out and buying, spending all their dough on, like, you know, sexual appliances and erotic monkey wrenches and shit, trying to compensate for what they don't have, the penis.
I hate everything that you're saying.
This movie did not even deserve the $7 million.
Well, it made $600,000 the second weekend, which is, it's what she deserves, .gif.
For real. This is a nice segue into Jersey Girl for three reasons.
I do feel like you cannot talk about one without the other. Even in my brain, hold the two very closely together.
I mean, I forget sometimes which one came before the, like, if one was...
So it was Gigli first?
It was Gigli first, then Jersey Girl. Okay. This is a nice segue into Jersey Girl for three reasons. One, this was Ben Affleck and Jennifer Lopez's other movie that bombed. Two, Ben Affleck has two movies where he has the power to make girls go straight for him. This one and the far better film Chasing Amy, which at least has the character of Amy having dated men and women versus a quick, sharp turn for Ricky and Gigli because penis does that with Ben Affleck.
You spend enough time with a man named Gigli and your fucking panties get soaked.
Magic. And number three, because both Chasing Amy and Jersey Girl were directed by Kevin Smith.
Ugh.
Jersey Girl was released March 9th, 2004. Is, of course, directed by Kevin Smith. I'm not going to go into all the movies Kevin Smith directs.
You know who Kevin Smith is.
You know who Kevin Smith is.
And if you don't, you're probably, like, anywhere near a computer or a handheld computer known as your phone. You
go
can figure
Google
it out.
That shit. Or bang it. Currently holds.
Ooh, and let us know what your favorite Kevin Smith movie is, because we got into a debate.
Yeah, I said Chasing Amy, and then I was like, no, I think Dogma's my favorite.
I said Mallrats, and then I switched to Dogma, and now I'm back to Mallrats.
Currently holds a 42% rating on Rotten Tomatoes, which...
Whoa.
Yeah, it's not that...
That's the highest one that we've talked about.
Right, and for good reasons. Like, it is
really?
Not...
Really? The reasons are good, Emily?
It is not a horrible movie. It got a lot more crap than it deserved. It's not... Is it Kevin Smith's best movie? No. Is it one of his really good movies? No.
Absolutely not.
But I wouldn't go as far as to say this is a really bad movie.
I mean, it's still rotten at 44%.
That is true.
And I'm sure you'll get to it.
So the basic plot here is Ollie Trinke, played by Ben Affleck, is a successful PR guy in New York after his wife, played by Jennifer Lopez for 10 minutes, dies of an aneurysm while giving birth to their daughter named Gertie, who's named after her mom. Ollie basically lets his shit go crazy after he had stopped taking care of his kid and kind of left her to be taken care of by his father, played by George Carlin. One day, George Carlin can't take care of the kids, so Ollie has to bring her to work with him at a very nice...
I'm sorry, George Carlin's in this?
Yes.
Okay, I've never seen this movie, because this was around the time where the Bennifer stuff was just everywhere all
control,
of the time.
All over the place.
And then I think that they even had delayed releasing this movie.
They did,
and
because of how bad Gigli was.
Yes, and then they broke up by the time that it came out.
Exactly.
And then when it came out, no one cared.
And what's crazy is that J-Lo is only in this for about 10 minutes. It's basically but that became a
part
cameo.
Of the, it became part of the joke, though.
Like, I think I remember hearing people were clapping when she died, which is horrible. Like, no scene depicting a woman dying during childbirth is, like, worth clapping over.
I also, no that is very, like, is. The Story of Us or whatever that yeah. fucking misery porn movie with Olivia Wilde exactly. and Oscar Isaac is called. How oh, of
yeah.
that movie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, yeah, to die while giving birth, like, she might as well fucking get hit by a bus stepping in front of a, while she's pregnant.
Yeah.
Might as well be the same thing.
Yeah. So anyway, basically, Ollie loses his job because one day when he has to bring his baby to work with him, he is having a meltdown because there was a snafu with changing the diaper, shit went down, and he basically has a meltdown where he claims his client, Will Smith, and this is like 1995, 96, is never going to be a good actor and is trash, and that's right before Independence Day comes out. So people remember this as a crazy meltdown. He's blacklisted by every PR firm in the city, and he is forced to move to New Jersey where his dad lives and raise his daughter there. So fast forward to 7 years later, she's in elementary school. He is a civil servant with his dad, and Ben Affleck and his daughter like to go rent movies together. One time he goes to the store and he has a meet cute with Liv Tyler, who plays a video store clerk slash grad student who convinces them to rent Dirty Dancing, which is highly inappropriate for a 7-year-old. And over time, they develop a relationship. At one point, they get caught about to have sex by their daughter. And,
ew. Yeah, make this stop. This stopped being about Jennifer Lopez a while ago.
And basically, he tries to get his PR career back after he has a successful PR moment, if you will, with the local townspeople for shutting down a street for doing construction work. He goes and tries to get his job back in New York while everyone disapproves because they love their life in New Jersey. He, after running into Will Smith in the waiting room for this job interview, and Will Smith doesn't know who he is, Will Smith talks about never spending time with his children, and Ben Affleck is like, that's enough for me to say no, I'm not going to go to this job interview, and he goes back to New Jersey, and they live happily ever after. And that's pretty much it. Fun facts. This movie did not make very much money. I don't have the exact number. It made more than Geely, but not very much. The film's budget included $10 million for Ben Affleck and $4 million for Jennifer Lopez's 10 minutes of screen time. The weird thing that makes this a full-blown Armageddon reunion was that Bruce Willis, rather than Will Smith, was going to be the original cause of Ollie's problems. And later on in the movie was going to show up in the cameo when he's in the waiting room to interview for his PR job. And then finally, Kevin Smith wrote the first 50 pages of the script with Bill Murray and Joey Lauren Adams in mind, which is crazy.
What the fuck?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's all I have for Jersey Girl.
I mean, yeah, it's not like we could have ended on Monster in Law and it would have been an uptick. I just feel like Jersey Girl and Geely together are so much bad movie. All crammed together.
It's
that Bennifer effect. It's exhausting. We're exhausted now, which is perfect because it's time to end this episode.
It's time to end this episode.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Old Millennials. You can find us on Instagram. We're at The Old Millennials Pod.
And we're also on Facebook at The Old Millennials Pod.
If you liked what you listened to, please go back and listen to our older episodes. They're all wonderful in their own way. And also, don't forget to rate and subscribe and review us. It helps other people find us. Or if you don't want to do that because you're like an off-the-grid type of person, which, you know, if you listen to our last episode, I talk about someone who is just like that but ended up on Next anyway. Why don't you tell a friend about this very show?
We love that as well. And we are on Spotify and iTunes. So check us out.
You can also follow us on Twitter. I am at Marg She Wrote.
And I'm at Emily A. Bijan.
And we don't have a Twitter for this podcast because who wants to follow a podcast
Too
Twitter?
Too much work.
So until next time, we say bye.
Bye.
Don't get hit by a dumpster when you get your shoe caught in a manhole.
Yikes.